UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. It's Pradeep Mundra here, and I'm your host for the UEG Talks today. Now, gastric cancer is potentially preventable, and I have covered this aspect with my very first podcast for UEG Talks with Professor Marcis Leija nearly 18 months ago. We did discuss various things and basics of Helicobacter pylori and things, and I would urge the listeners to listen to that episode, and this goes in conjunction with this episode. And one of the things in relation to this that I often notice routinely in my clinical practice is huge variability in the quality of upper GI endoscopy in terms of reporting gastric premalignant lesions. And I find that these are often missed. And if sometimes they're reported, they're reported very inadequately in terms of the extent of the premalignant lesions and everything else that comes with it. And this has huge implications in terms of patient management. And often the offer of surveillance or no surveillance for such patients ends up being potluck, so to say, depending on how the endoscopist describes the findings or the clinician's interpretation of the endoscopist's report. And I suspect the reason for this is lack of awareness, and previous guidelines had addressed this issue, but may not have been crystal clear or crisp in guiding us clinicians. And on that note, the European Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy have now updated their latest guidelines on this topic, called the MAPS 3 guidelines. And whilst we can't cover the entirety of the guidelines, today's discussion is about the most important aspects of this. And to discuss this today, we have none other than the lead author for this guidelines, Dr. Mario Diniz Ribeiro. Professor Diniz Ribeiro is a full professor at the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Porto, consultant gastroenterologist at Porto Comprehensive Cancer Center, where he's the head of the department and vice director of research center. Welcome to UEG Talks, Mario.
Thank you.
So, Mario, I've been looking at the MAPS 3 guidelines in preparation for this. It's extensive compared to the previous ESG guidelines and very amazingly succinct. And I have to give all kudos to your team and you and your team to put this together, and it's 40 pages long. Can I ask you, to begin with, what is the scope of these guidelines and how this was developed and what all aspects have it covered in these guidelines?
Well, first of all, thank you again for inviting me, and I hope that we can have a discussion around, we believe, a nice guideline and a very comprehensive guideline. And that was the main aim always of the team that embarked on this adventure. So, as you said, this is the third edition for this guideline. And when we started in 2011, 2010, when we kicked off the first guideline, we joined forces with the European Helicobacter and Microbiota Study Group. Well, it's obvious because the Helicobacter is the main risk factor for gastric cancer, and also the European Society of Pathology, because finally, it's all about merging the concepts between endoscopy and pathology on managing these patients, but we'll have the chance to go to that topic. So every 5 years, approximately, the guidelines, they have to be updated. And meanwhile, of course, they are exposed to the community and lots of discussions occur in conferences. And we felt along the line with the recent systematic review that even though the guidelines have been uptaken, there was sometimes some discrepancy in the way they were read. This is on one side, so it's probably not anymore a lot of heterogeneity, but on the other side, a lot of discrepancy in the way the different guidelines from different parts of the globe, they were, let's say, understood. Also, there were some areas that have not been covered, and there were some criticisms, because, of course, you can manage a patient when it comes finally to your outpatient clinics. But what about enrolling the patient at the very first moment to endoscopy, or how to deal with special situations? And finally, ESG decided also for other guidelines that we would be even more comprehensive in terms of organ. So the ESG did that for Barrett, and we did this in terms of how to manage, finally, if we find out the superficial lesion that would be resectable. And that's why at the end it became quite a long guideline. In the top of that, we also aim to have the consequences in terms of greener endoscopy. But we did not, of course, did cover everything. So the readers of the guideline may miss also some technical and training concepts, but this can be found elsewhere.
So you covered screening here, surveillance, identification of premalignant lesions, management of such lesions, and treatment of Helicobacter pylori and all that. I guess for the benefit of audience, Mario, we probably focus less on treatment of dysplasia, and we will cover some of it, but I think predominantly we'll cover screening surveillance, which is more important to our colleagues, because management of dysplasia as such is dealt in by specialists, and we'll cover less on that, hopefully. Let's see. Now, let's start off, Mario, with the screening for gastric cancer and premalignant lesions. And in the guidelines, you mention three different domains of screening. Can you expand on that and briefly explain what this means and how it's best done?
Yeah. Of course, there is always some differences in taxonomy if you speak with different groups, but at least within the guideline, we aimed at discussing population-based screening when we refer to an entire population solely defined as the setting and or the age, like we can discuss for others, the screening or target screening. That would mean that you further define a subsetting again, like for instance, if we would be defining screening for Barrett's or for other diseases like pancreatic cancer, etc. And then lastly, a screening / opportunistic diagnosis that we suggested that in every gastroscopy should be done. That is probably a chance when a citizen comes to the health system for the first time, and it's probably a lost moment if you don't care about looking carefully to the stomach and detect what you should be detecting. Of course, if the first two, meaning the population and the target, would be more, let's say, more or less to be defined by policymakers and when and how to implement, and maybe we can discuss further this. The last is for everyday clinicians to decide, and that should be applying what we suggest in the guidelines.
Okay. Let's briefly dwell into population-based screening. And you do make some statements about this in the guidelines. Can you briefly tell us how this is done, where this should be done, and when it should be done, how frequently?
Yeah. Well, some of the answers are not, let's say, there yet. Yeah. So, for instance, there is some evidence to suggest that in Eastern countries, that of course we are discussing mostly for Europe, even though this guideline has been taken by others in different parts of the globe. But of course, if the country as a whole has a very high incidence for gastric cancer, probably justifies to implement even a standalone screening procedure for gastric. Standalone means that that individual would be recommended to make an endoscopy or any other method for screening, such as serum pepsinogen or other measures such as primary prevention, such as screening and treating for H. pylori. If we move to Europe, we may not have such areas with a very high incidence, and we discussed mostly intermediate and low areas. So the suggestion that we make is that if for that specific area it's finally shown that it's cost effective to have screening for gastric cancer, then it should be implemented. So of course it's a circular suggestion, but we open the door to the projects that are ongoing, like TOGAS. It's a European consortium that will address these topics, and we may find out different answers in different parts depending on facilities and finally the costs. Of course, I will not go into detail on cost effectiveness studies, but our suggestion is that if in a specific area it's finally shown that it's cost-effective to go, for screening we should go. The suggestion is also made in the previous position statement and also based in even for the states in some cost effectiveness there, that it may be cost effective to synergistically approach the population together with the colorectal cancer screening. How? Well, we could go for FIT-based plus seeking for H. pylori. I guess that Marcy has already alluded to that in his talk. Or if the patient finally comes to colonoscopy, either from primary colonoscopy towards screening or FIT-based programs, we could add up the upper GI. This was shown to be cost-effective almost one decade ago, and also recently when we addressed by our group also the role of AI in intermediate regions in Europe, such as Portugal, Romania, some parts of Spain and Italy, etc. So these were the suggestions. In Europe, I think we could differentiate between intermediate regions and low-risk areas. For the first, a synergistic approach could be cost-effective.
To summarize, Mario, within Europe, there's no high-risk regions.
Yeah, we can define Europe in different ways. So, but there may be some specific regions that I don't know by heart in different countries where it may be justifiable, but in general, there are no high-risk areas.
Okay, so the intermediate-risk regions, so you can consider screening as long as it's cost-effective, is what you said. And most European countries are low risk, except for Portugal and Eastern European countries. And screening is not advised based on the guidelines. Is that correct?
Yeah. That is our suggestion. And also, for instance, if we discuss the low regions that are more frequent in Europe, one topic that is also important to mention here is that we didn't include this in our definitions. When we speak about screening, probably should be organized, meaning that it can address all the population, like we were discussing before, or eventually, even if for low-risk countries, to be organized means that probably either first-degree relatives or some ethnicities or some immigrants should be probably proposed to screening. For instance, the result of a cost-effectiveness study is also in at the USA, and there is a sub-task in TOGAS that will address these kind of questions. Because even if it is not cost-effective for the entire population, there is a nice manuscript published by the Dutch group alluding to the ethical aspects of not going for a general population and going only for some segments. That on one side, of course, you increase paradoxically equity by proposing to those that are probably lost, but you can also bring some prejudice to those that are, let's say, the target of a specific screening such as this, because they can be, let's say, identified as such a group with a high risk, etc.
So you can consider screening for high-risk population within a low-risk region, kind of technically speaking.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Now, once a patient develops a premalignant changes within the stomach, does geography or ethnicity play a role in progression towards cancer or any other factor that plays a role?
That's a very, very important question. And I think this is a very practical one. And that this was one of the reasons that motivated the systematic review that we were able to publish in GUT last year, that where we systematically review the guidelines. And all of them tend to say that when we detect such as changes, we need to, first of all, we will not surveil everyone, and we will have to select those that merit surveillance. Then there are some differences in the schedule of that surveillance that we can come back. But in principle, the answer is no. It doesn't matter if you are Portuguese or Dutch or Norwegian or German. Once you have that phenotype at risk, then you should be surveilled. And it's the same of having adenomas in the colon or Barrett's. So this is an important message that sometimes eventually we may think that the same reasons that led us to implement a screening procedure would affect then the decisions towards surveilling or not. And this is a different, let's say, moment in the pathway of managing an individual.
Well, Mario, some of the audience may, I'm sure everyone knows, we describe pre-malignant changes in the stomach. For the benefit of audience, can you describe what they are?
Yeah. Within this scope, mostly we are discussing trophic changes in the stomach and the presence of intestinal metaplasia. Of course, it's a marker of atrophy, but it's a step. So the polyorchorea cascade, the perfect cascade, suggests that from a normal mucosa, there is a progression from gastritis, then atrophic changes, then intestinal metaplasia and final dysplasia. What we understood is that this is not, let's say, this does not occur in 100% of the patients, of course. And from step to step, there are some, let's say, markers of further increase in the risk. For instance, if the atrophic changes and intestinal metaplasia are more frequent in the stomach, meaning they are seen in several parts of the stomach, those are the individuals that merit surveillance rather than the others. We will come back for sure for this to discuss about this.
One thing that struck me, probably a bit of practice changing, or at least I've not come across this in any of the previous guidelines. You make two statements on the relatives of patients with gastric cancer. You just alluded to just now that ethnicity and things may not matter, but family history does matter in terms of elevated risk. You mentioned two things. You mentioned about Helicobacter pylori screening, and you mentioned about endoscopy screening for such individuals. Can you explain what recommendation the guideline committee made and how strong is the evidence for making such recommendation?
Yeah. So just to stress, and this is again nice to have this chat. So what I've said is that for determining if the patient has to be surveilled or not, in principle, ethnicity does not matter. But for instance, when defining an organized screening program in a low-risk country, it may matter. But coming to the first-degree relatives of family of patients with gastric cancer, well, first of all, it's an easy marker. Yeah? So all the clinicians should have the family history of their patients. Secondly, patients, they know that marker, and eventually they can be empowered to seek health care and health resources. The evidence is not that strong. But it's not that strong also for the colon, where we anticipate the screening based on an increased risk for colorectal cancer of a certain magnitude. So for gastric cancer and also for premalignant conditions, what we observed is that family, first degree relatives of patients with gastric cancer, and it doesn't matter too much if it's from the intestinal type or diffuse type, they do have an increased risk for gastric cancer and for premalignant changes. So based on this, and also consistently with other, let's say, panels, we suggested that we should go for an anticipation or eventually only for these, the primary prevention moment where we seek for H. pylori and we eradicate. If we speak with patients, this is what we say. That is, what can I do to avoid what my brother had or my father? And of course, we are discussing outside genetic syndromes. Okay. And then there is a second moment of secondary prevention. And for that, the suggestion that we've made is not with a strong evidence because we don't have trials. We don't have many studies suggesting that we should do what we suggest, but on the other side, it's the best we can suggest to someone that has a relative, that is to anticipate somehow an endoscopic screening procedure for detecting what I said. We hope also by suggesting this, that eventually either it's consolidated by the community, by further studies, or it's contradict, and then we need to adapt the recommendation. But this is kind of consistent also for practice in most countries and also in some of the guidelines that use. This is probably the most consistent marker, even for instance in Europe, for the Spanish guideline that somehow does not suggest as commonly the surveillance for some of these patients. The family risk is there, and also for the surveillance after treatments.
Yeah. No, I think you recommend two things. You recommend Helicobacter pylori testing for first-degree relatives between the ages of 20 and 30 and OGD at the age of 45 or 10 years before the age of diagnosis of the affected relative. I think this is something I think people should be aware, because this is not something we have traditionally done in clinical practice. And it came as a completely new knowledge to me, which I have not been offering, although it was in the back of my mind.
Of course, there are many health problems that we need to deal with. And of course, there will be priorities. But if you think along an aging population in Europe, also with some immigrants with an eye in between countries, and also other risk factors that prevail, like smoking, obesity, salt intake. So all of those makes probably this measurement of family history so easy that it may lead to a screening procedure and an early diagnosis. Because again, there is also a notion that I think it's important to disseminate, that is, even though the incidence, so the number of new cases over those that are at risk has been decreasing year after year in Europe, we face an increase in the number of cases because of what I said before. Yeah? So in Europe, what is expected is that the number of cases will increase during the next decades. And if we don't do anything in terms of early diagnosis, the dismal prognosis will continue to be observed.
Well, in what I see lately, the number of endoscopies that we do is significantly gone up. And the number of patients, older patients we're subjecting endoscopy to, has gone up. And more we do this, we're finding pre-malignant lesions in the stomach in older patients. Does the guideline committee make any recommendation of either not doing surveillance? Is there any age cutoff for not offering surveillance for these patients?
Again, of course, we need to take care of all patients. On the other side, we first do no harm. So this is the other side of the coin that we were discussing before. That is it reasonable for someone with 88 years old, asymptomatic patient, to suggest to that patient a screening procedure for any disease in the luminal GI tract? No. So we set a bar at 80 years because life expectancy in Europe is now increasing. Or if for that specific individual, it doesn't make sense in terms of life expectancy because of other comorbidities. I think this is bringing to the stomach what has been said in the colon and also in Barrett's recently. That is, at a certain stage, you should not only, let's say, you should stop. It's not giving up of that individual. It's allowing that individual not to be submitted to procedures that probably will not affect, finally, their life expectancy.
Yeah. I guess that boils down to this career cascade that you mentioned, that you go to stepwise, and this takes often years to change. And even if it is an early gastric cancer, by the time that kind of progresses and causes harm to the patient, it may take some time, right?
And it leads then to difficult decisions, because then, okay, if finally you detect the lesion, and then how to say to that patient that I will not treat you because, well, probably finally, exactly what you say, you will not suffer from this specific disease. So I think the message is, regardless of the screening program that you organize, there will be an age limit. Or at the individual that is in front of you, don't start making procedures that finally may lead to diseases that you were not, let's say, interested in managing, or the patient was not interested at all in knowing that at that phase of their life. So this is difficult, but I think it's an important recommendation. Of course, there is no evidence about this. There is some scattered evidence of showing that. Then finally, for instance, if you treat the cancer that is non-curative, you don't send the patient to surgery. So it's very questionable.
Mario, we discussed earlier that what I see in clinical practice is huge variation in terms of reporting of premalignant lesions, and that the main reason for this is lack of awareness by the endoscopist. And certainly when I see our trainees, most of the education they get is from peers, from their trainers, who are also not so of recognizing these lesions and describing these lesions. Is there any resource that we can refer to? I don't know, could be just videos and things for our listeners to get some training in recognizing and describing these gastric pre-malignant lesions.
So this was probably the only thing in terms of, let's say, technical perspective that we brought to this guideline, that there were some hopefully considered nice pictures. And in fact, the descriptors that we may use to describe the presence of a trophy, but namely intestinal metaplasia, that is quite more reliable, even among observers that are considered to be experts, are similar to that, to those that we observed in Barrett's. So for most of the European endoscopists, if they are used to describe Barrett's, they will be able easily to learn how to assess the gastric mucosa. Regardless of that, there are some educational tools delivered by ESGE, of course, reserved for ESGE individual members. And we will have a course coordinated by EU within a consortium that is called UCanScreen that will have three editions during the next 2 years, two in Portugal and one in Lithuania, where at least 30 participants, 30 trainers will be able to participate and learn more about this. So be aware of this and be ready to register in those courses.
I think for those, the guidelines are amazing. The way the pictorial representation of the tables in the guidelines are really good. And if people want to refer to those, I really suggest. And that's the best way to know. And it's very simplified in the guidelines, I have to say.
So we've had some wonderful conversation for the last 30 minutes. There's still a lot more to cover, and we'll be discussing this. But as we've gone past 30 minutes, we thought we should end this as the first part. There's still lots to discuss in the second part, which will be discussed in a week on the 9th of July. So there we continue our discussion on MAPS 3, the recommendations on the use of artificial intelligence, the management of early gastric cancers and identification of pre-malignant lesions, and of course, what the acronym MAPS stands for, which has been a bit of mystery so far for me. Be sure to tune in again next week. Goodbye.